Thanks very much, Mark, and very happy to be here today. Mark asked me to speak on a couple of issues, which I will do. Firstly, what is the future for securitisation? And secondly, and relatedly, what's going on in the provision of credit in Australia at the moment? So let me talk first about the future for securitisation. I actually talked for quite a long time about this yesterday at the securitisation forum. So I'm just going to recap the main points I made there. The conclusion I got to yesterday is the future's looking brighter for securitisation, but I don't expect it to return to the heady days of earlier in this decade where securitisation accounted for about one quarter of the flow of housing credit in Australia. So of the housing loans which were written in Australia earlier in the decade, about one quarter of them ended up in a residential mortgage-backed security. But I do think so we're not going back there, I don't think, anytime soon. But I do think securitisation will be an important part of the financial landscape in the future. So prior to the crisis, many commentators, including us, sung the praises of securitisation as a useful means of dispersing risk around the financial system. And in principle, I think they were right. But there were, however, as has been made very apparent, some major shortcomings in the execution of securitisation. And I've said before, and I said it again yesterday, there are a lot of similarities between securitisation and junk bonds, not because of their credit, but just the way that they emerged. Both were important financial innovations that were well-founded, both grew too rapidly and expanded into areas they shouldn't have, and were bought by investors who shouldn't have bought them. Both played important roles in generating financial dislocation. Junk bonds were a major part of the financial turmoil, relative to what we've had recently, but financial troubles in particularly in the US in the early 90s. But just as junk bonds are now a regular but much smaller part of the financial landscape, I think securitisation will move in that direction in the future. However, as with junk bonds, much needs to be done to restore the brand name of securitisation. Some of this will only come with the passage of time. And I mentioned yesterday, one way they restored the brand name of junk bonds in the US was to jail a few people. So Michael Milken, most famously, ended up spending a bit of time in jail. And it's interesting to note in that regard that 2 days ago, the case that the SEC, I think, was bringing against two of the major Bear Stearns participants in the mortgage-backed security market in the US actually got the jury decided they were not guilty. They were guilty of being stupid, but they weren't guilty of misleading investors. So to some extent, if they weren't able to prosecute them, then which I thought was not being a lawyer, but seemed to be a reasonably decent case, I think they're going to have trouble prosecuting anyone else. I'm not saying that jail is the solution to restoring securitisation's brand name. Certainly not in this country. And in fact, that's the next point I want to make, which is the Australian securitisation business has been markedly better than that in the US, and it's performed both in its performance and in its execution. So the problems in execution I mentioned earlier were primarily those in the US. They weren't those in Australia. But unfortunately, securitisation in Australia, by the continual reports in the media of what's going on in the US, most people assume that the similar has happened here, and that's just not true. So Australian RMBS has been and continues to be a very strongly performing asset, and that message just needs to be continually got out there. And the differentiation between Australia and the US in this regard needs to be continually highlighted. That message doesn't need to be delivered to the people the investors who buy this stuff, the portfolio managers at funds. It more needs to be delivered to the superannuation trustees. I mean, some of you are superannuation trustees who sit on the boards and say, just assume that securitisation is bad and that their fund managers just shouldn't be buying any of it. So the Australian industry really needs to differentiate its product from the US brand. And so some of the main differentiating factors are that, unlike in the US, the credit quality of Australian mortgage-backed securities has remained at the highest level throughout the financial crisis. Even at its peak, which was earlier this year, the arrears rate on Australian mortgages in securitisations was less than 1%, which is extremely low by international standards. By way of comparison, the arrears rates in the US at the moment is north of 5% and it's still rising. Over the past year, actually, the arrears rate in Australia has actually declined. Moreover, unlike in the US, the bulk of Australian RMBS are backed by prime full doc loans. In the US, subprime loans, which everyone now is well and truly familiar with, made up a decent part, sort of one quarter to one third of securitisations in the US. Australia did not and does not have a subprime problem. So despite this good performance, I think there are, and which I said, that message just needs to be continually got out there to people, that to something to restore the brand name of at least Australian securitisation, there are some developments on the demand side of the market which suggest that the market isn't going to go back to where it was a few years ago. At least one third of the investors in Australian mortgage-backed securities were offshore structured investment vehicles, or as they're now much better known as SIVs. These institutions just aren't around anymore. They've basically all been liquidated. And hence one part of the market which Australian issuers used to target just isn't there anymore. So that part of the demand side of the market is just not there, which probably means there's going to be less supply. That liquidation of those SIVs has actually been a major factor inhibiting the recovery of the market in Australia. So as these SIVs sold their mortgage-backed securities, they dumped them back in the local market at a very low price, which generated an overhang of stock. Local investors were much, not surprisingly, were much keener to buy those cheap securities that were being liquidated back into the market rather than be interested in the new issue, which was much more expensive. But our assessment is that that overhang in the secondary market has largely been eliminated, and you've seen the price of these securities start to rise considerably again. And that elimination of that overhang has contributed to the revival of demand by investors for primary issuance. And we've seen that in the last couple of weeks with some successful issues of mortgage-backed securities, particularly by Members Equity, or ME Bank as they're now called, without the support of the government through the Australian Office of Financial Management. Moreover, Australian mortgage-backed securities pay off, everyone in Australia keeps on paying their, or has kept on paying their mortgage at least the same rate as they used to. So the stock of those securities actually declines, if nothing else happens, by about 20% per year, just by the rate at which Australians pay down their mortgages. So the value of securities out there in the market has actually declined by 40% since its peak in June 2007, and that's starting to create some holes in the pockets of investors or in their portfolios. So I think there are pretty good reasons to believe that the signs of life that we've seen in the market in the last few months, it's likely to indicate more activity to come in the future. So securitisation is coming back as a viable form of financing. However, a number of the non-bank originators who use securitisation just aren't there anymore. So what does that mean about the supply of housing credit going forward? First, despite what you might read in the media, it's worth stating there has not been any material restriction in the supply of housing credit throughout the financial turmoil in Australia. Growth has slowed in Australia, but it's still going at an annual rate of 8%, which in some countries is actually regarded as quite high. Margins on variable housing lending relative to bank funding costs have actually declined a little over the past 2 years. So banks have actually had a margin squeeze on their housing book. The margin between the standard borrowing rate and the cash rate, which we set, has gone up, but the margin between overall bank funding costs and the rate they lend to households has actually gone down. So households, or people with mortgages like me, have actually benefited quite nicely out of this, or in relative terms. So while those margins have gone down, how have the banks made their money is maintain decent profitability is because they've offset that by a widening in margins on business and personal loans. So the overall bank margins relative to their funding costs have actually widened, which is very evident in their most recent profit statements. So while housing margins have declined, will that continue to be the case going forward, given there are less competitors in the housing loan market after the crisis? But I believe there are good reasons to think that competitive pressures will continue to restrain the ability for any margin widening on the part of the larger banks. The housing loan market remains contestable, even if there are not as many competitors out there as there were a couple of years ago. So by that I mean that any excessive widening in margins will attract new competitors back into the market, particularly, as I think is the case, the securitisation markets return. Just let me say just very briefly a couple of things about what's going on the business borrowing side of things. Basically, business credit or business borrowing has declined is actually declining at the moment, but there are a couple of things going on here. One is that businesses have gone out and responded to the financial crisis by raising a lot of equity and have voluntarily reduced the level of gearing on their balance sheet. In other cases, they've been encouraged, with capital E, by their financial institutions to go out and raise equity and reduce their leverage. So we've seen a lot of equity raising, so that overall business financing has actually gone up, but they've used that equity to pay down debt. So much so that the gearing ratio of the Australian corporate sector has declined by about 20 percentage points over the course of this year to what is actually a reasonably low level. So we think there's less demand for business credit. There's also clearly less supply, and that's most evident in the commercial property sector, where it's clear that there are supply restrictions. The final thing I'd say there, though, is that while the banks have been clearly less willing to lend to commercial property, and they were looking back at what happened in the early 90s, that was what caused them the most problems, they haven't actually pulled the plug, generally, on it, their existing exposure. So they've actually decided that if they all pulled the plug, their position would be a hell of a lot worse. So they've tried to maintain the market where it is, but they're just not providing any source of expansion because they just don't want any more exposure to the market. So while they're pulled back on that side of things, though, the lending to sort of smaller businesses still seems to be going along at an okay pace. So our overall assessment is that housing credit, perfectly adequate supply out there at the moment at a price which is perfectly reasonable. Business credit, there is clearly an issue of, there are issues on both the supply and the demand side. Businesses have voluntarily decided to reduce their amount of borrowing. Banks have encouraged that. And in some cases, and in particular sectors, most obviously commercial property, they've actually scaled back certainly the provision of any new credit. All of this, including where the margins are going, are something we clearly take into account in our setting of policy. So, it's clearly a major input into our assessment of how changes our monetary policy affect the overall economy. So let me finish there.
I guess as much as anything, a question for Guy. There's been a lot of talk about education and offshore education, of the fact that Australian securitisation is different. I don't necessarily buy that, in that having done enough roadshows, I believe offshore investors understand the Australian market is different. Maybe we need to fix the perception here. One of the greater concerns for me on education, however, is you talked about subprime. In Australia, it's become the accepted norm that subprime is equivalent to low doc. Low doc loans in Australia are virtually impossible to get. Australia is built on the back to a large degree of small business. All these small business owners cannot get mortgages. So we talk about the demand for Australians to run their own home. If low doc disappears, there will be a massive portion of Australia that can no longer get a mortgage. And at the moment, it's accepted that low doc is subprime and it won't exist. How do we change that? How do we educate people on that?
Actually, in my speech yesterday, I didn't, in fact, draw that. I made it very clear that subprime, which is less than 2% of the market here, is sort of non-conforming loans, not low-doc loans. Low-doc loans are a regular part of they make up about 10% of most securitisation. So, on the education front, as I said, someone else, I think, said about educating offshore investors. I said, the people you need to educate here are superannuation trustees and asset consultants who are very, they're like the old super tanker. It takes a hell of a long time. Once they've changed in one direction, they're headed down that route. It takes a hell of a long time to get them back in another direction. I think it's partly this perception that, But it's also at the individual investor level. So we've seen plenty of examples of this, and I'm sorry, David's seen a hell of a lot of this firsthand, where the investor would come in and say, do you own anything related to a mortgage or anything securitised? And if you say yes, they say, well, I want my money back. It's like, oh, hang on a sec, this thing's still paying you a very nice rate of return. I said, no, I want my money back. So there's a lot. We've seen plenty of examples over the last 5 years of irrationality in investors. But first of all, in one direction, and then the last couple of years in the other direction. And I don't know how one can... we can talk about education, but I'm not sure how much you would, how ultimately you address that. But beyond, as I said, I see it partly as just going out there and reinforcing the... reinforcing the message that this product is still, you know, it's delivering a very strong rate of return. You know,
that's not the low-doc loan. In the government's eyes, low-doc is subprime.
No, well, I don't think that's true, but that's not true here. But in fact, if you look at the announcement the Treasurer made a couple of weeks ago about extending the AOFM's purchase program, he actually explicitly talks about looking to see how that can incorporate more small business low-doc loans. So, I mean, that's the AOFM's mandate, which has not yet been fully determined for the second $8 billion that the government's just allocated, is exactly on that.
I guess this is a question for Guy. What then do regulators and central banks do about it? This I guess, raises the great debate about whether asset prices should actually be targeted.
I mean, the Fed had clearly had, and they said this explicitly, that they did not believe that they had the wherewithal to identify when asset prices were there. They said they were considering this position at the moment, and their asset price excesses were there, and therefore, I mean, when it all boils down to it, if you're talking about dealing with it with monetary policy, then you're actually talking about making someone unemployed to control that asset price. So if you actually take seriously the dual mandate that we have and the Fed has, at least, then that's what it all boils down to. Now, if you're only going to talk about interest rates, the other things, the debate is at the moment is what other tools might you consider which don't involve throwing someone out of work to control that asset price. So, the other thing is, I suppose it's interesting to think about, and we've got more evidence on this now, is that when you take the dot-com boom, then the fallout from that was actually pretty minimal. So there were a few people who in Silicon Valley who lost some share prices, but I don't think that matters all that much. They didn't probably care about it, they cared about it, but it didn't matter for the greater society all that much. So there was an instance where there was a large asset price expansion and contraction, didn't have a hell of a lot of effect on the real economy all down the track. This time around, we've had a large asset price expansion or spread contraction, and the fallout has been immense. There are 10% of the U.S. workforce are out of a job at the moment, large part because of the fallout of the asset price. So the calculation this time around is it would have been a hell of a lot better to have stopped that happening in the first place.
Absolutely.
Calculation in 2000 was, I don't know, I think that was probably no big deal letting that happen. And so then it comes down to the what was the difference between those two events? One difference was expansion of credit. So this one was a credit event. The stock market, the dot-com boom, was a cash event, by and large. And so then that starts to, you know, then you're focusing more on something which you mentioned earlier, which was the focus on sort of what's going on in terms of credit expansion and the nature of credit expansion. Which would have led you to different conclusions in those two episodes, and then what do you do about it if you think that there are excesses, which is basically where the debate is at the moment.
Just two quick questions. Guy, you talked about the other ways of perhaps rather than just putting people out of work. Perhaps could you give us some examples of policy measures that perhaps the government could adopt or should adopt to further that aim? And secondly, your paper yesterday talks about the opening up of the securitisation market, and your comments today talked about there being adequate housing finance. But just in general, overseas, we have lovely sunny skies here, but overseas people are concerned about double dips, fragilities of the world economy. Is there a concern of a downside or a return to some problems in the credit market?
So on the first one, the tools you're talking about there are much more. So the big buzzword around at the moment is macroprudential, which no one knows what the hell that means, but it's a nice word to throw around. Which it just means something besides monetary policy, right? So you throw that. So that's the big.
I've thought every conference you go on to, that's the word we should have thrown around rather than global imbalances. But anyhow, so what does that, yeah, so you'd respond to global imbalances and macroprudential tools. But the, so what, what the, what does it, what does that mean? So some of the things we mentioned earlier, so in terms of capital, so different capital charges. One is, sort of dynamic provisioning. It does, varying risk weights over the course of the cycle. So, or even having sort of LVR standards, say. So at the moment, there's some of the agent, Singapore and Hong Kong are concerned about what's going on. Property prices, they're changing LVR, they're changing maximum LVR ratios. I mean, as Bob said, though, if you tighten up on one part of the sector, then, people innovate to get around it. That's going back on what David said, that's basically part of sort of the modus operandi of the financial sector, really, is innovation. And part of it's, a lot of it's innovation around regulation. It's a decent driver of innovation. But that's always going to happen, and I think you just got to, that's a fact of life. You throw sand in the wheel, some of it sticks and it slows things down, but yes, other things come up around it, but you've just got to be aware of them. In terms of credit, I mean, are there downside risks offshore? Still, yeah, certainly. No doubt about that. There's some concern, particularly in the US at the moment, the primary concern seems to be around commercial property. If you go back to the early 90s, and I think we talked about this in our last financial stability review, if you look what happened in the early 90s in commercial property in the US, it was about 1 or 2 years after the sort of bottom of the cycle that the large losses in commercial property actually were still coming through and hitting banks' balance sheets. I suppose one thing which is interesting, which hasn't, is that a lot of the commercial property exposure in the US is actually not with the larger institutions, it's actually with all the regional institutions. They're very concentrated regional commercial property exposures. And so while the damage we've seen thus far has been on the big, in the investment banks and the larger banks, the damage going forward, particularly from the commercial property side, is likely to be on that second tier of the US, or the second tier and below of the US banking system, the people outside the 19 bank institutions which were stress tested earlier in the year. And that's where that damage might be, which then potentially slows the provision of credit to sort of in Germany is called the Mittelstand, and potentially it inhibits the pace of recovery there.